While working, he eats kale and pets a cat. Bill King is a multitasker.
Every Tuesday joins us, and Buck, as a player, and this is May, so everybody's throwing out their predictions and everything. When you were a player, did players pay attention to predictions, magazines that would come out, or later online predictions?
Bill, I think... all indications when you would see, our thing would be more so when you saw what the Pac-10 media or those folks were voting right before the season. You know, we had magazines that were out and there were articles that were written, but it was more so when that happened, because we were just working out, getting ready for the season for the most part. It wasn't as much coverage as it is now, clearly, but I do think whenever you kind of saw that, and if they had you listed as six out of the 10 teams in the Pac-10, you were like, okay, we got to show these guys something. But I don't think we paid a whole lot of attention to it because there wasn't as much coverage as it is now. I mean, you got to think about all the different outlets and everything that covers college football that has grown exponentially, probably because we were doing a pretty good job of either showing people that we were better than what they thought or vice versa, and just the money that's now involved in it. So I think it was a little bit different. You wanted to, I guess, avenge maybe whichever loss you had the year before, or if you felt like you weren't being taken seriously, how could you play well early in the season, because we had those early season games. And I know losing to Nebraska my sophomore year gave us a certain fire, because we had struggled with Big 8 schools, which were the top dogs, whether it was Oklahoma my freshman year and then sophomore year. We went to Nebraska and Lincoln and played actually pretty well, but still got beat. And I think we took it upon ourselves knowing what we had to do that next year, and that's probably what kind of got us over the hump. So you kind of, those were the things that we thought of more so than what was really being written, what actually we could do on the field and how we could make a difference there.
Charles Arbuckle with us. I would think one thing you would note, and everybody has their enemy, you would probably note who was picked higher, Southern Cal or UCLA.
Yeah, I mean, that was a given. I don't think we had to even worry too much about
right.
That one. It was funny, I think, with most of those rivalries, you know, we knew those guys. I mean, being in the same town, like 13 miles apart, a lot of those guys went to high school together, played against each other, or played on the same teams in high school. And then once we start, you know, UCLA was recruiting Texas pretty heavily. USC did the same thing. So there were guys that I knew from home that were over there just like they did on our side. So, yeah, you definitely wanted to have an advantage over your rival, for sure, for sure.
I brought this up, I think yesterday, maybe Friday, but I think yesterday. Back to the NIL topic, which will be a topic, I guess, but forever with the shows and everything. But isn't it ironic that one of the mainstays of NIL was supposed to be the schools cannot be involved? They cannot be recruiting to it, making promises, things of that nature. They're totally... supposedly, we know this isn't the case, supposed to be disconnected, and the collective will do all of that as far as raising the money. You can recruit them, obviously, like you always have, but it can't involve any discussion of what you're going to get, which is laughable. But that being the rule, Buck, maybe that was the mistake of many. Maybe the schools need to be involved in this, because if you've got a collective handling all of this, you've got problems on your hands.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also, too, I think they've been working on something, and I just, you know, I've been doing more research on the NIL, and there were some guardrails that they were trying to provide starting in 2020. there have been things that they've been trying to do to kind of pull this in order and not allow certain things. And to your point, the collective was supposed to be the arm length organization that stayed away. The coaches would know, the schools would know. In theory, if your listeners right now said, well, did he actually say that? Yeah, I said it because in theory, that was what it was supposed to be. Well, we've had this theory kind of process for a number of years, right? And I really think if you go back and you look at the history, the NCAA should have been moving fast and really understanding, I think, in 2014 when the Ed O'Bannon case really became the impetus for NIL as we know it today. I don't think they ever really thought that this would go and continue to grow like it did. And that was years ago. They've had a lot of time and opportunity to maybe look at it and try to build some of those guardrails. But you can't now go back and say, okay, we have this collective, which is basically we're gonna guarantee that as the kids come in, we're going to be the holding house or the clearing house for the NIL that will be taking place at the school. Well, if you do that, Bill, you always are going to have folks that just aren't going to follow the rules. There's not going to be a way that you can quantify who's with the school and who's not. And so as you read through this information, it was set to fail by the NCAA before it even really started, before they even really started putting guardrails supposedly around it. And this is a 31-page paper. If you look at it, it's like there's no way they're going to be able to do that. So each thing that you read is because it was a reactive response to something that you had to be proactive to, and it should have been proactive 2 years ago. As you were building those TV deals, as you were doing all those things, you had to make sure that there was things in place to say, our main entity, the thing that makes us great, the schools are great, right? Yeah, the colleges, we love them, but it's the players that are on the field that are really providing you with this. What are you going to do there, and how are you going to make sure that they don't then turn around and say, look, where is it for me? And I think that's what you're seeing a lot of. And I think there's so much that has gone on. I don't know how they're going to kind of turn that around or change course for something that has been moving so fast and furious for so many years.
Josh Arbuckle, Tuesdays, joins us. Georgia Dog says, ask Buck. Georgia had a lot of people picked on defense that won't be there next year on the best defense in America, but they also were able to liberally substitute. So a lot of players got a lot of playing time who will be back. Maybe they didn't start, but they got some reps, some good quality reps. He wants to know, the people out there thinking the defense is going to take a big step backwards, do you think that's the case, considering the talent they have and, again, some of the substitutions they were able to get in last year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been the big thing for Georgia, having the opportunity to make sure that they have really good players coming back, right? And, you know, I think there's some guys that are really play. The first thing that comes to mind, though, is not so much the guys that are coming back, that's the coaching staff, right? I mean, you lose a Dan Lanning who, I know as good as Kirby is and all the things that he can do, you know, that to me, one thing that concerns me is when you lose folks like that. I'll say this, Jalen Carter, who I don't think ever got enough credit on that defense, was one of those guys that just, you know, was a phenomenal player, and I think he is really going to make a difference. You know, Ringo, got a name that always showed up and making plays. Chris Smith, Nolan Smith, you know, they've got some guys that can still play on that defense. So I'm not too much worried about the players. It's just more so, are they, you know, sometimes when you lose your voice or you lose some of your coaches, that to me worries me a little bit more than just the players themselves, because I don't think talent wise, I don't know if there's anybody that's recruited as good as Georgia over the last few years and gotten a number of 5 stars. They've developed their 3-star players, and it's shown now by them winning. But what is that going to do, and how is that going to affect them from the standpoint of – and all those coaches, you know, when you talk to them before we did the game with Charleston Southern, they have a lot of good coaches on that staff. So I'm not worried that they're going to not play well. I mean, I think Kirby has figured out from Nick's perspective, okay, I have people coming in and I have people leaving. How do I make sure I don't lose what I need to there? And that's going to be interesting to see with this Georgia defense this year.
I don't know if you've got a chance to meet Marcus Freeman, but he's got the number one ranked, at least at the moment. It's May. We're not at the finish line. Number one ranked class in recruiting in the class of 23. People say that you can't recruit to Notre Dame like that anymore, and he's not listening apparently to that.
Yeah, Bill, you know, I've been on a few Zoom calls with him. There's some things that happened in the offseason where I've had a chance to, you know, listen in on some conversations with Marcus Freeman. I haven't met him personally yet. I'm looking forward to it. But I do think the one thing that he's thinking and what I like about him in every conversation is he's saying, look, we're going to make sure we have the right footprint of guys that we recruit or we identify. And we're going to be very strategic in how we go about it and make sure they understand that what you can get with a Notre Dame degree, what it means, what the alumni group. Because, you know, it's interesting. I hear a lot about the NIL, and I think that's great. I think the money that you're going to make in college, I wish I had the opportunity, but I'm not jealous or upset that it didn't happen in my era. But what I do know is that's what's still true is that that's for a small percentage of guys. It's still going to be that large percentage that need to have life after football that are going to be like me, a five-year NFL veteran, thought I was going to play 10, you know, not happy when that happened that I didn't play longer, but glad that I had my degree and been able to do some things because of that in both corporate America and then broadcasting. So I think the thing that he's selling, he's going to get the right guys. And if you can play, Notre Dame has had that whole thing of, well, you know, they can't compete against the big boys. I don't know. If you can get the right kind of players, Cincinnati showed you, and he was with Luke Fickell at Cincinnati. He's been at Ohio State. He understands how to recruit the Midwest and get some of those guys in the Midwest and other places, getting back to California and Texas, making sure that they're getting some of the best kids that Notre Dame had back in the day, right? They would go and just pick guys out of wherever they were, pull them in, whether it was an Aaron Taylor, whether it was Jerome Bettis, whether it was, you know, Tim Brown out of Texas. You know, they could really do that. And I think that's what he's – what I hear him talking about is really one of those good things. And I would have to say the one school that I keep kind of thinking could impact them could be Michigan. I don't know if it's going to affect Ohio State as much, but Michigan could be the school that – loses some, because think of what Michigan's had. They've had a really – Jim has been able to recruit really, really well, but they hadn't been able to beat Ohio State until last year. I'm wondering now, when you get a guy like Marcus Freeman coming to your house and schools that are very similar academically speaking, even though one's a state school, one's a private school, you know, I get a sense that if he can keep recruiting well like he is, they're going to develop the talent. I don't have any doubt about that. And I think they become younger in the sense of how they're going to do it. He's a relatively young guy, and Tommy Rees is a relatively young guy. And I know Bill Reese's son very well. I've known him since he was a baby. Great offensive mind, and I think they've set this thing up to be, you know, have a guy that runs the team, knows the defense, and then has his offensive guy that can make things happen. So it'll be interesting to watch Notre Dame. I'm not saying they're going to win a national championship next year, but I like what they're doing, and I like how they're being more aggressive with what they're doing on the recruiting trail, but also how they're just branding themselves as something different. And we'll see if that translates to more victories for them.
Charles Arbuckle with us. Buck, have a fantastic week, sir.
Hey, man, you guys do the same. Thanks a lot.
There he is, Charles Arbuckle. Marty, Bill, listening to Buck at the Port of Jacksonville down in Florida. Appreciate that, Marty. Appreciate you checking in this morning. Gator Dave on his Green Acres phone, according to Allen in Tampa, coming up